Everyone, good afternoon, good evening in different parts of the world. My name is Nipun, and I'm delighted to be your host for this conversation in our Law of Love webinar series commemorating Gandhi's 152nd birthday. So welcome and thank you for joining us. The purpose of these calls is to share stories that help plant seeds for a more compassionate society while also fostering and cultivating our own inner transformation. We do this by holding these collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life who inspire us to live in a more service-oriented way. I should add that behind each one of these calls, there's an entire crew of service-based volunteers whose invisible work is actually what allows us to offer this. Today, our special guest speaker is Jayanti Ravi. So many of us are very excited about it. And thanks again for joining this call to hold that space together. Before we begin, we always start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves in this space. So if we could just hold a minute of silence to kick it off. Thank you. Thank you. And welcome again to our Law of Love webinar series. This was actually inspired by a very specific quote by Gandhi. And most of you might have already heard it, but I think it's worth repeating again. He says, just as a scientist will work wonders out of various applications of the law of nature, a man who applies the laws of love with scientific precision can work even greater wonders. Nonviolence is infinitely more wonderful and subtler than forces of nature, even like electricity. The law of love is a far greater science than any modern science. And so we are here exploring that. And today is a very, I think we have a very unique guest because Vinoba Bhave offered this metaphor of panchashakti, you know, five fingers of a hand, where he said community, education, business, nonprofit, and leadership and government. And so here today, we have a guest who actually works at the intersection of all five of those. And it's a very, very unique person to actually meet that can span all five of these sectors. So I want to introduce Jayanti Ben, but before I do, I just want to make one quick announcement that if, as we start the conversation in the later half, or at any point, if you have a question on the live stream page, just submit your, there's a form, just submit that form and the questions will get to us. You can also email ask@servicespace.org. So most of you already would already know about Jayanti Ben, have read about it online. Her resume is a little bit unbelievable, but it's true. She does have a master's in nuclear physics. She has studied at London School of Economics. She has received her MPA from Harvard. And she did go on to become, she was Commissioner of Education, Rural Development, Health in Gujarat. Overlooking hundreds of thousands of staff and directly impacting millions of kids. I mean, this is, I actually didn't know one of our co-moderators was someone so many of us in service space adore. Her name is Swaraj. She unfortunately got sick, so all of you are stuck with just me today. But she was telling me about the scope and the breadth of the work. But what she was also saying was about the inner journey of Jayanti Ben. You know, she at the outer level, she's been part of historic legislation. She's been part of teams that have created the RTI Act, for example. But here as just a human being in search of something deeper, I suppose, she's also a performing vocalist. She knows so many languages. I think she might even be a Sanskrit scholar. I know her mom definitely is a Sanskrit scholar. She's an author of many books. But what she says, what makes her happiest is when people call her a teacher, when little kids call her a teacher, you know. And so I don't know how to encapsulate all of this into a phrase or one word, but I was thinking about it and I was like, I think all we can say is old soul. So it's a, she's a person, just at a personal level. I remember my wife and I don't, this would have been probably 10, 15 years ago at least. We were sitting there, and I think we had this smile deck that came out, which had like unique kindness ideas on each one. Now imagine like a commissioner of education, and you're sitting there talking about big things in the world, and then we have this smile deck of doing small acts of kindness. And so we all picked out a card, and then we had to go and do that act. And I think Jainti Ben's act was to do something for your neighbor. And the next time I met her, she was like, "Nipun, Nipun, I did that. I did that act." So I don't know how she spans all those spectrums of scale, but she does. It's a joy to have known her. It's a joy to welcome her on this call. Jainti Ben, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Nipun. It's such a pleasure to be a part of the amazing, incredible work that you are all doing. And you've also been a great source of inspiration for me. And I do look forward to sharing whatever little bit that I can. And I think it's incredible what you have been able to do.
Oh, that, thank you, but probably just a drop. I think what we want to do is, since you are such a fan of music, fan is probably not the right word, but we have an incredible singer amongst us to open our call. Radhika, I turn it over to you to share an opening invocation for our sacred space together.
Thank you very much, Nipun. And before I begin, I want to thank my dearest friend Sachi for introducing me to this universe. You know, Jainti Ben was right. There is so much inspiration right now in this group. I am so fortunate to be here and very grateful to you, Nipun, Sachi, Rohit, for this beautiful location. And what I really want to sing is what I want to sing is this. There is a Kabir Sabad in the Guru Granth Sahib. And that is so Guru Granth Sahib, as a scripture of the Sikhs, has besides the bani of the 10 gurus, has three other invitees. There is Kabir, there is Namdev, and Baba Farid. So what I want to offer today, going with what we are, the theme of the evening is this sabad. It says Aval Allah Noor Upaya. First, God created light. Aval Allah Noor Upaya, Kudrat ke sab bande. Ek Noor te sab jag upja, Kaun bhale ko mande. When we are all born of the same light, who is bad and who is good? There is no telling, because all of us have the same light within us. And that is bin Kabir's and so many other Sufi poets and Bhakti poets. Theme. And one more verse which I want to just read. Khalak 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 meh khalak pur rahiyo sarb thai. He's saying the creation is in the creator and the creator is in the entire creation, and we are, it's all pervading, it's all permeating. So that's the theme of this sabad, Aval Allah. सब बंदे अवले अल्लाह नूर उपाया एक नूर ते सब जग उपजा एक नूर ते सब जग उपजा कौन पले को मंदे अवले अल्लाह नूर पाया, अवले अल्लाह नूर पाया। लोग का परम न पूलो पाई, परम न पूलो पाई। खालक खलक खलक मह खालक, पूर रहियो सरब ठाई। एक नूर ते सब जग उपजा, एक नूर ते सब जग उपजा। कौन पले को मंदे, अवले अल्लाह नूर पाया। माटी एक अनेक भात कर, साजी साजन हारे। ना कछु पोच माटी के भांडे, ना कछु पोच कुम्भारे। एक नूर ते सब जग उपजा, जा। कौन पले को मंदे, अवले अल्लाह नूर उपाया। अल्लहु अलख न जाई लखिया, गुर गुर दीना मीठा। कहो कबीर मेरी शंका नासी, सरब निरंजन डीठा। कहो कबीर, कहो कबीर मेरी शंका नासी, सरब निरंजन डीठा। एक नूर ते सब जग उपजा, एक नूर ते सब जग उपजा। कौन पले को मंदे, अवले अल्लाह नूर पाया, अवले अल्लाह नूर पाया। कुदरत के सब बंदे, अवले अल्लाह नूर पाया।
Thank you, Radhika.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Gentlemen, we are once again delighted to have you here. I want to start our Q&A by reflecting on your early influences. I'm always very fascinated by sort of the nonlinear. I think when we look at our lives, when we look at the impact, certainly of someone like you, we say, oh, well, she did this because of this, but it's actually never linear like that because there's so many nonlinear influences. I'm especially thinking of your, you know, the visual you had given of your mom when you were young. You were writing like math sums on the floor, and the visual that stood out to you was you turn around and there's your mom like just humbly mopping the floor of that chalk. And I know your parents have been a big influence for you. So I wonder if you can reflect a little bit about the early influences that have rippled into your life.
Thanks, Nipun. I hope I'm audible. And right at the outset, I also want to take maybe a minute to thank Radhika for this beautiful Shabad. And if I may just share one influence, which was not a very early influence, but yes, early, but a more recent one. You see, I was once on election duty in Rajasthan at a place called Hanumangarh. And during that, I came across a Gurdwara there. And there are these people in the Gurdwaras called Ragis. A Ragi is a person who sings these Shabads literally every pore of their body, because they do this every day. And it's full of, you know, there's something phenomenal. So I had the privilege, I went there, and it was like a visit for a few minutes. And then I saw the Ragi there and requested him, will you teach me some Shabads? He took a special liking for me and started coming almost every evening. He would come to the circuit house late in the evening, teach me a Shabad or two. And of course, much later, he also came to Gujarat. So when she sang this Shabad, Aval Allah Noor Ubaya, it brought back those memories too. And so I wanted to specially thank her and thank you for rekindling those special memories. And now coming back to your question of the early influences, I think to a great extent, it was my parents, my grandparents, particularly my grandfather, my maternal grandfather. In a lot of ways, I think he was a kind of a giant of a human being, because his father, that is my great grandfather, had been in those days a deputy collector. But I think at the peak of his career, due to certain fortuitous circumstances, he had lost all the power, the position, etc. There was something. So the entire mantle came on him. And I think the way he rose to the occasion and really brought up, and it was a very deep spiritual anchoring that he had. And that's something that he, I think, passed on to us. And so he would carry us to, as a child, I remember going to talks of J. Krishnamurti, Swami Chinmayananda. And I'm not sure, as a 10-year-old, 8-year-old, I really understood a lot of it, but I think a lot of context was getting built there. And similarly, my parents, and I think I've been very privileged to have the parents that I have, in the sense our childhood was in a lot of ways a little unconventional. We didn't grow up in one place steadily over all the years. So there was a lot of movement physically. You got sort of transplanted to another city, town. And as a child, I'm sure all of us have realized this now at this stage in life, if I'm posted somewhere where I have a little room office of my own, I have a table, I have a few people that I get to work with, etc. But as a child, you have to, you're planted somewhere, and children are absolutely delightful, but then they also have their own little groups, and they're not initially very open to someone new coming in, because that person speaks a different language. Maybe, you've come from another part of the country, and these were very extreme. It was like from Jamshedpur, which was the eastern part of the country, to Nadiad, where the language was Gujarati. So I remember somebody telling me, Pacharja, Pacharja. I was standing in the line, probably right in front. I didn't know what on earth was she saying. So starting with those kind of things. And so I think the influences, but over a period of, I think, 3-4 months, the same group, which seems very difficult. You don't even know where the washroom is in that school. You've suddenly gone there. You don't know where, who are the friends, where do you drink water? It's all new. The language is different, the culture. But I think in a matter of 3-4 months, and I think this really teaches you this lesson of being able to adjust, being able to make friends. And within 3-4 months, you were really, it was like a, what is it called, a house on fire? You're really friends with a lot of people there. And then you're speaking the local language with a lot of finesse, and then again, it's time to be yanked out to another school, and then it's almost heart-wrenching, because at that time you've made friends and you don't want to leave them. So this was also one of the influences. So I had to hop in and out of almost 7 schools in childhood. So it used to sometimes almost border on being a little harsh on me, I thought, because this whole thing of suddenly you've become friends and you're almost having to tear. In those days, you didn't have Facebook and different ways of being in touch with your friends. But then at home, I think the influence of my parents, that was a constant thing wherever we went. And my mother, as I was sharing the other day, she's been a very, very devoted mother, extremely humble at this age, achieved and accomplished so much. And yet you'll probably think of her as probably the epitome of patience and humility. And so she would teach us simple things at home in a very, natural way. She'd be doing all the household chores and she would use a chalk and give us little sums. And then she kept us, kept me busy, and she would be mopping. So in a way, she also checked it. And then so the child was, you know, engaged in something fruitful. And similarly, I think my dad, I think he's somebody who always made us believe that there's nothing which is impossible. So always encouraged us to follow our dreams. And there was never this feeling that, well, you can't do this. Anything that you felt you wanted to try, you wanted to do. You know, a lot of times without knowing, we tend to be a little conservative in terms of encouraging our children or the people in our team. So I think he made us feel that the sky is absolutely the beginning. You can do whatever you want. Of course, it entails hard work, focus, strategy, and so on. And I think I'm very privileged that today they have been a very integral part of my life. And so that's about the early influences and the schools, the different cultures, the different food, everything. So long answer to your question, Nipun.
Oh, it's beautiful. You know, of course, a big part of you is being a teacher, being an educator at all levels of scale. And I want to talk a little bit more about that. But I also to lead into that, I actually read the dedication of your book, Symphony of Fraternity, Social Enterprise for Human Upliftment. And you dedicated the book, and I quote, it's to Professor Kirit Joshi, and you say, who silently and sweetly stormed into our lives and transformed it with love, truth, light, and ananda. So I was wondering if, you know, about some of your influences on your philosophy of education, but specifically Kirit Bhai, who seems to be a very prominent influence in your heart of service.
So I was answering your question in the sense, who were the early influences? Kirit Bhai came into our lives much later. I think, if I remember the day right, I do, it was 15th of September 2009. It's as clear as that. I'll tell you why in a minute. So you see, I can be a little free here because I think it's about sharing things in a very informal sort of setting. So I had a phone from my PA, my personal assistant, as she was called, a wonderful lady called Leela. She gave me a message. I was in some other meeting. She called and said, there's some advisor to the chief minister who's come, called somebody called Kirit Joshi. I mean, we didn't know who on earth this was. And she says, you have to go and call on him. And I still remember telling her, Leela, I'll just go meet him for 2 minutes. I'll just finish the formality and be right back. And I went, and at that time, this was in the antechamber, because that meeting was so very impactful. And then that was the beginning of a continuous series of meetings day after day, which I thought reflected genuinely what I'd written in that book, Symphony of Fraternity. So I went there, and this was the antechamber of our Principal Secretary of Health, called Dr. Hasmukh Adia, again, an excellent, outstanding officer who later was, of course, at the center and so on. So he had gone as, destiny, or as the divine sometimes ordains it, he had gone for another meeting with the chief secretary then. And so Kirit Bhai was in the antechamber, and I went in and I find this person all dressed in white, and I thought it would be some political appointee or someone. Not that I don't mean anything loaded there, but I just thought, I didn't know if we would really, the wavelengths, I didn't know anything about him. I started talking for a few minutes, and then those few minutes went on for, I think, an hour and a half. And Mr. Adia, who was to return back in 5 minutes, he for some reason got caught. So look at the way everything, you know, there's sometimes this divine, what is the word for it? So it just happens, connives that way in a good way. So we had this discussion and so many things, and he told me the importance of the number 7. So it was 16th September. So he said it's the number 7, and that was also my number. Several things that we discussed. I knew very little about Mother and Sri Aurobindo, except whatever little one had been exposed to. But I think after that came a very intense engagement with him, because as a part of my work, I had to sort of interact with him on a daily basis. And what was beautiful was any question that popped in my mind, I could ask him. And there's also something a little personal. Maybe a few months before that, I would really have these intense conversations with me, sometimes wake up in the middle of the night and pray, and sometimes with a few tears flowing down my cheeks, I would pray and ask, would I ever have the privilege of really working or, you know, being with somebody who inspired a leader, that kind of leadership, which was not just about power and authority and rules, but a combination who knew, who was brilliant intellectually, and yet could really function from that space of love, exactly what you said about this law of love. There was a very intense prayer somewhere. This was after I returned from Harvard, and I felt I needed to have that kind of an experience. So this was a very ardent prayer that I would, it was happening. It was not something that I had designed, or it was something that naturally happened. So I thought this was an answer to that prayer. And he was instrumental in drafting and making the Children's University happen, the Indian Institute of Teacher Education in Gujarat, the Gujarat Commission for Educational Innovations, and a host of things. But I think most of all, I was probably the biggest beneficiary of his presence there for nearly 2.5 years. And after which too, he went back due to his health, his poor health, he went back to Pondicherry. He was in a place called CARE in the ashram. But something again, whether it was, it would be, you know, not that I'd ever been to Pondicherry before, but something would, my work would take me there. There would be something there. And I got an opportunity to be in regular touch with him. And even on the unfortunate day when he physically left the body, it was not definitely something that I'd known. I'd not even planned to go to Pondicherry, but I was in Chennai the previous evening because there was a convocation at the Ramakrishna Mission Vivekananda University at Coimbatore. So they'd invited me there as a keynote, whatever the guest there. So I was just staying back that night, and that morning one saw this sad news and was also present at the time when he sort of departed physically. But to say that certain people come into your lives for a great reason, meaning, and so, well, that's the way this person sweetly stormed into our lives. And it was not just me, I think the entire family, my biological family and a bunch of people in Gujarat that we were all working together in education. So I think that was something beautiful that we all experienced, and that sweetness continues.
No, and I'm curious. So he walks in, you don't know him, and you go in and have a meeting, and that meeting goes on. So what was it in that conversation that drew you in, and that actually you might say stormed into your heart in inexplicable ways? Like what was in that conversation that was drawing you in?
So we started, I mean, I thought it would be a very perfunctory, the usual conversations that sometimes you end up having where, you know, you're asked about the targets and what is the achievement, what have you done? But it probably started with just a few pleasantries, introducing yourself, and then he would say something and then I would respond back. It was something like this conversation that you and I are having here. It was more about, and there were so many things that he was also sharing about how he was in the civil services in 1955, how he had this inner calling, and 1 year later had this courage, and probably he couldn't be otherwise. He resigned and went to the ashram and worked there for perhaps nearly 20 years. And as fate would have it, in the mid 70s, he was again brought back by the then Prime Minister to a position of a special secretary in Delhi in the Ministry of Education or Human Resources Development. So I mean, all, and then also various things about our beliefs, what are our ideological, what are the aspirations for education, what do we want. So it's as if suddenly all that you wanted to share with or get, you know, the nurturing, the ideas, it suddenly felt that there was some small unexpected space that was really expanding. And the conversation, I think that was one long conversation that went on till the day he, not only till the day he left his body, but I think even after that, I mean, any questions, you sit and think, and you do hear his voice saying Jayanti Ben and then explaining the whole thing with so much sweetness. So
That's beautiful. I want to get a little bit into those educational aspirations. You know, it's a few years ago, maybe more than a few now, a bunch of volunteers had come to your place and visited you. I think they were dropping something off, interacting, and then they came back and they said, "You won't believe this." And I said, "We said what?" He says, "You know, Jayanti ma'am is like, you think of her as this giant personality, but then we were talking to her and she says that she goes under a tree and has 12 students from the local community nearby where you live, and she teaches them." And I don't know if I got those facts right in terms of whether it was under a tree or whether it was 12 or not, but I remember that feeling in their heart saying, wow, like here is, you know, somebody who's affecting millions of kids, and yet she comes home and she's like, I want to volunteer to help the kids in my neighborhood. So being an educator is a very big part of you. And I also remember reading in one of your books, you referenced the UK government's 4 foundational pillars, right? Learning to know. So that's content. You really got to have that together. Learning to do, which is not just head, but hands. Learning to live together, which is really about emotional intelligence, right? Which is about relationships. And then learning to be, which perhaps gets to the spiritual. And I found those 4 pillars to be pretty telling. And yet in, you know, most of the conversations that you hear around education, you rarely have such a holistic sort of a dialogue around education and what those systems and policies could be that could inform such a, you know, such a context. So I wonder if you could speak a little bit about the educating the heart, so to speak, leading with values in the realm of education. What are the bottlenecks and how can we perhaps transform that?
So a lot of times when you're in the civil service, while the scale is phenomenal, the impact that you can make, but then at the end of the day, sometimes you also have this little vacuum because you're dealing with files, you're dealing with a large number of people, as you mentioned. I mean, in health, for example, you were dealing with 150,000 people working with you as a part of your team. If you looked at the students, medical education, that would be approximately another 150,000. If you looked at the, you know, Ayurveda, you know, all the different paramedical students, medical MBBS, PG, postgraduate, all of them. And so while you feel you're impacting all of them, sometimes there's a part of you that also wants to have this experience of actually being able to learn or you know, facilitate learning. So there's this thing, and I feel in a way what I'm doing now at Auroville is in a way a contrast between what we normally do, which is more like paddy cultivation. You're doing these huge numbers, macro level, to rose cultivation, where you're taking up individual cases. So one always felt this little hunger, appetite, for also wanting to complement all this that you do in terms of policy, files, all of it, with this real experience of what is it? What is it that happens when does the eyes of the child light up when he or she understands? So this was, my husband and me would go for walks in a, there's a little park in Gandhinagar, which is where we usually stay, and in Gujarat. And so this is, of course, we found that it had just rained and there's a little bit of water in that lake. Normally the lake doesn't have water. It's a park. And so we had these little children from the neighborhood who were there speaking the dialect of Gujarati locally. And so we found we were picking up some of the, you know, papers and wrappers, plastic things that were lying there, and putting it in the dustbin. So these kids, too, wanted to know if they could you know, help us. They started doing that. And then this conversation led to, they came up to us, and one of them, I still remember his name. His name was Poonam, a little child, and his eyes would have this little bit of an askance. He would have eyes that were slightly, you know, thin and something a little impish about those eyes, but a very, very sweet child. So he looked up at me and said, "Tame teacher cho?" So I kind of said, "Well, not really, but what is it, shuche?" So he said, what he asked me, "Are you a teacher?" And then he says, "Will you take a tuition for us?" And suddenly it got me very interested, because this is something that I was genuinely feeling hungry for. I wanted to have this experience, you know, netting the dough with my hands kind of thing. So so when I said yes, the first next question was, "How much will you take?" You know, ketla lesho. Then we said, "No, it's not about money, but you'll have to come regularly." And then that's how this whole thing started. And of course, the numbers slowly grew. And we had at one point of time almost 25 to 30. So it was like one morning, it would be about an hour or so. But what was fun was that some of these were children in the sixth grade and so on, who couldn't, they couldn't count beyond the number six. They couldn't add single digit numbers. But when you sat with them, and I think there is this dimension of education, which is, of course, we talked of the cognitive part, psychomotor skills, but there is also something called the affective or the cognitive, which is more about the heart, the emotional part as well. Sometimes if you just explain, so we would start with laddus. Laddus are these little sweet things, and say if you've had three laddus and two laddus, and if you add it up, it becomes five and so on. We found that in a matter of maybe a week, less than a week, most of these kids were able to not only perform additions of single digit, even eight digit, nine digits with carry, and that gave them a phenomenal sense of achievement. For them, this was like the Nobel Prize. Till then, they were sitting in class, not able to understand how this happened. And imagine the struggle. I mean, you're sitting in a class the whole day without understanding something as basic. It must have been a terrible torture for them. But this is probably the situation in a lot of classrooms, a lot of children. So the key to it is, of course, the right teacher, the right method, and so on. And of course, every teacher has this potential, but then it's something that we inherit. It's a legacy. Maybe we've not had this experience. And unfortunately, in many countries, exceptions like Finland, in fact, in many of these teachers' training programs, I've asked them sometimes this question, if we all closed our eyes and were honest and asked, how many of us joined this profession because we really loved it? And you unfortunately also realize a lot of teachers come here because they didn't get into medicine, engineering. So there is a certain peaking order which is there. But if collectively all of us could really glorify this profession and tell them what a great, because they're actually going to be building the entire society. And if for every child like that who's stuck in this little thing, and it's not that they're not bright, they're very intelligent. Intelligence is homogeneously distributed anywhere. It's not that talent is only in the cities and not there. It's just that if those little obstacles are, you know, cleared for them at that right time, then this whole gap, and then sometimes surmounting that gap becomes next to impossible. So I think these were some of the, and I think if the right teacher disposition, I think, would be the key. It's not about brick and mortar structures. It's not about all of that. That is important. I'm not belittling it, but I think most important is the attitude and disposition of the teacher. And I think intrinsically, like this prayer, Avalallah, we all have it in us, but sometimes maybe that little kindling of it, maybe you need some candles to light these candles which are there in all of us. And that is something where all of us collectively have to do something.
I remember a quote by Parker Palmer. He says, "We teach who we are," which I feel like is such a great example. I mean, ultimately, if you can just create the context for even the teachers to teach who they are, I feel like we don't really pay as much attention to it. I realize I'm asking you like very broad swipe questions and having you condense all of this, so we may not be able to get to it, but I get to everything. But I do want to, I know you're at the moment, you are most excited about multiversity. And I just wanted to reference that. I don't know how you soundbite that in a short amount of time, but if you could give us that vision that you're holding, because I was very intrigued. We have university, which is one. What is a multiversity?
So this idea sort of took shape, I think, around 2011, when I was completing my research and Kirit Bhai was at the center of it. It so happened that he had come in, and then the research, which had actually begun way back in 2002, was almost getting completed. It was about something called technology enhanced learning. So there was a huge program that the IITs were implementing, where some of the best teachers and lecturers that were being offered in the IIT classes were being thrown open for the general public. So one was researching that and then came up with a model of what could be a way of leveraging all this phenomenal open education content resources that you have. It started with that, but then we came up with a hybrid model. But now what we're thinking of is, of course, it's gone through several iterations, several more additions in it. The idea is you have all these institutions, which could be universities, institutes of national importance, like the IITs, IIMs, and so on. And if you had another layer, I wouldn't say a layer above or below, because the idea is not a hierarchy, but if you had another structure, a very loose structure, but which allowed these students studying in all these other entities to be able to cross-register. So you had a layer called a multiversity. So you have these universities and you have something called a multiversity, which allows for cross-registering. You may be a student in, let us say, IIT Gandhinagar or IIT Madras, but if you want to do something on desert ecology, and there is the Gujarat Institute of Desert Ecology at Kutch, if you wanted to go and do an internship there, a reading and research program, physically or even virtually with some of the scientists, the researchers there. And now in the context of integral education, which is the forte of Sri Aurobindo's, the philosophy, his philosophy, it's basically integral education is what he has given us. And that in a way is the USP of Auroville, the ashram, Sri Aurobindo Society, and all the centers connected with the philosophy of Sri Aurobindo and the mother. So we thought, as a very fitting tribute, our homage contribution on his 150th birthday, could we really think of weaving in integral education and offering it also as a standalone course program, and also weaving it into different domains of knowledge. For example, at Auroville, you have some of the best exponents of solar energy, for example. Similarly, there are some amazing people doing work on forestry, even on farms. You name it, there are so many areas where there are some incredible, amazing work that people are doing, and which is rooted, anchored, and based on this concept of integral education. We have an Earth Institute where this whole thing of construction using local material, adobe, sun-dried bricks, and so on. So there's so much that is happening. But if you can have this open up for the rest of students from the rest of the world to come and partake, and also help co-create this, but not just a brick, it shouldn't be a brick and mortar model, but also it'll be a hybrid where it allows for both face-to-face, virtual. So it'll allow the seamless integration in research, extension, training, and education. So that is what the multiversity is about, as it's still, it's in the plane of ideation, and a little bit of drafting of a draft bill, etc., is happening. It's evolving, and we do hope that we're able to see this. This will be something phenomenal for the country and for students, and this is for the global audience as well. You could have students from different parts of the globe also who want to come here, and vice versa. So it's still work in progress, and do hope it reaches fruition and you're able to.
Absolutely. I come from the technology sector in the Silicon Valley, and I'm just thinking, if one of these bright minds at UC Berkeley is given a chance to do Gandhian economics at Gujarat Vidyapeeth, that would be a very different kind of a startup founder. And that's the kind of thing we don't have any infrastructure to facilitate that. So I find that to be very intriguing. I want to shift a little bit. I have a whole bunch of juicy questions. I don't know. I feel like we need a series of these talks. But for this conversation, I want to shift a little bit to development. You have also done a lot of development work. At one level, I think hearing you, looking at your vision, looking at the work, tremendous work you've done, you clearly know a lot. But I think what's unique about you is that you're also rooted in the not knowing. I remember this quote I read in one of your books, Andrew Culliver's poem. You say, you know, every day I'm astonished by how little I know and discouraged and obedient I am to the demand to know more. And that's the beginning of the poem. But the end of the poem, it says, and it is then that I notice that the invitation didn't say come armed with knowledge and a loud voice. It only said come. And I find that to be very intriguing, that there is this quest to know more, to understand, to grow, and to honor the capacities of our head. But then there is this surrender and humility. And you have had so many experiences. You know, I think a part of your upbringing was in Pune, and you would talk to the construction women workers. You were for hours, and that informed your worldview. At that time, you didn't know you were going to be leading hundreds of thousands of people doing rural development for a state or the country, right? But at the same time, you had that in you that, oh, what can I learn from them? So I'm wondering, how do you straddle this this edge between knowing, quest to learn more, having confidence, having conviction, and at the same time, being curious, being open, being surrendering to the sort of not knowing? Like, how do you hold these things together? And how is it informed, perhaps even an example of what you learned from the construction women worker in Pune growing up?
So possibly, I don't know. I think all of us, we do realize, and I think, as somebody said, the more a tree is laden, the more it bends down. I think then there's also this curve. I forget the name of that curve. There's one that when you know very little, you probably feel a little slightly overconfident. You feel you know everything, but then but as you start delving deeper into it, you realize. So I think this is nothing special of me. I think it's a common trait of almost all of us, many of us. But one thing I realized probably, Nipun, is also that the fact that I've been trained in certain other dimensions as well. For example, recently my brother, who's also an amazing, he graduated from IIT Madras and went on to work in the Silicon Valley for many years with Cisco. But then he's also parallelly over all these years been an amazing percussion player, a mridangam player, and he has a school there with nearly 800. He's trained nearly 1,000 kids, which is a great service that he's also doing. And so one of the things that he said really struck me and made me realize, he was recently giving a workshop here. And when he said that, as an artist, and that too, if you're a performer, you go to perform, and you don't know on that day, your throat may not be okay. You know, it's something you spontaneously create. And I think that vulnerability is something that we have to accept. If we pretend to be, absolutely smug, knowing everything, I don't think a lot of these things, including the work that you do, there's so many things that you really do not know. You don't even know. What are the different points of view? You straddle so many things. You may have an idea. It's not a very mathematical. Even mathematics sometimes is not. There are possibilities, probabilities, all of it. Choice points, chance points, and so on. But it's not a very cut and dry logical thing that I put two and two together and you are going to get a four. Because even when you work in public policy, you may want to set out with a policy for building and other construction workers, for example. But then when you have the stakeholder meets and so on, you realize there are so many stakeholders pulling in different directions, not in a bad way, not in their agenda. But it's just that there are different people that you have to straddle and find that eventually that acceptable thing where you are much better off than where you started. But nevertheless, you may not really get that perfect utopian ideal solution to anything. So especially when you work at scale, the system too has its own let's say, drawbacks, systemic inefficiencies, problems. You too, I think, with all this that we try, sincerity is high, but I think there's so much that we don't know, and we make these guesses. We go and something like COVID, I was in the hot seat as commissioner and later on as the secretary of health for 4 years, and it just, nature tells you how little you know. So even people at the cutting edge of science and research, you know, you think this would be the solution, and maybe 2 weeks later you make a complete U-turn. So a lot of things you really cannot be absolutely sure about things happening that way. But talking of the construction workers, I think I have a fascination for people too. So it starts with that. But in the process, when you talk to people, it's not, when you engage with people, you need a bridge to talk to them. And so the conversation, it doesn't happen in silence. Much as you intrinsically love human beings and you love to connect with that Avalallah, that Noor within, that really lights you up. But to reach that, you have to have something to transact. And probably, I'm not sure, I'm just articulating it now. But as a child, I used to love these, construction women, men, and I'd find them, coming home in the evening, making their rotis. And I thought, in a way, it seemed like such a simple existence. You know, you finished your day's work, you came there, ate, and it seemed at one level, but also it was fraught with so many difficulties. If someone fell ill, the whole thing. So it was not something that made me feel very sad or upset. It actually taught me the lesson that you can be cheerful even there. So life, and you can choose not to be cheerful even if you had the whole, everything that a person may want or need, not just need, but want. So I think these conversations have helped. Even years later, when I had the opportunity of teaching at Harvard, I'd find that I was teaching quantitative techniques, math. But with several of my students, I think the math was probably a medium I would love to teach. But it was not about the math bit. But I think beyond that, connecting, when you taught a class of, let's say, 150, when they were there, if the eyes started lighting up, then they understood something and came and shared about what is it that in school they had not understood. I think that basic human connect is what really gives me a great deal of joy. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, sure it does. I'm very curious about your practices. I remember one of my friends, a longtime volunteer of service base, he would say he'd never lost a case he was an IP lawyer, he'd never lost a case in his life. And his mom at one point says, you know, Mark, you only do stuff that you're good at. And so he picked up soccer. Like I would say probably in his 40s, 50s, he's like, you know, I'm terrible. I'm like two left feet even when I dance. And so he went and he started playing soccer and he was just failing at it, you know. I would be curious, and maybe at a later point, but I'd be curious how what are some of your practices to stay rooted in the unknown, especially being in seats of such tremendous power, where I'd imagine a lot of people are just saying yes to what you say. But I want to weave that into a second question, though, a related question, which is around power. You know, Swami Vivekananda said, a heart whole, sincere, a few heart whole, sincere and energetic men and women can do more in a year than a mob in a century. And so at some level, scale has its appeal. And then at some level, there's something about being a part of this few and deep and sincere, right? So and I'll even bring in examples, two examples that I know from your own life, right? One is you go out as this, you know, big commissioner to a village, and they need to dig make a toilet, and you're like, how long will it take? And everyone's like, well, ma'am, 20 days, 10 days, maybe 12 days, you know, but max. And later in the day, you start digging the toilets, you know, and everyone's like, oh my God, like she's going there, gotta do it now. And similarly, you went to a university, and I know this because someone else told me this story, and they still talk about it. I think you went to this place maybe five, eight years ago. And when they went, they had booked you in a 5-star hotel. And you said, I want to see where, they were showing you the facilities and they showed you the dorms. And you said, well, cancel the hotel booking. I want to stay with the students and I'll stay in the dorm. And to this day, like everyone in the school, when they think of your name, they think, oh my God, they may not remember what you said in the talk, you know, but they will definitely remember that, oh man, gentleman, oh, she was the one who actually slept with the students. And so you have this frontline mindset, and yet, you know, you are in positions of tremendous power. And it's sort of related to the knowing and not knowing. And so I wonder if, oh, that's a long winded question perhaps, but I wonder how you hold that. What are your practices so that you don't tilt too much in one direction, because you clearly sometimes need to have very strong footing and the other. And that seems like a very interesting edge to hold.
Yeah, I don't know, but I think probably, Nipun, when you sit and analyze these, of course, with the intellect, maybe this plane, and you try doing things with sincerity, I think you practice that too. I think a lot of times there is something beyond, and when you try and work in that intuitive state, being a little reflective, there is something that you hear. So when you are open to listening to some things within you, then it does. It's fairly loud, you know, tells you that, no, maybe you should stay here, and then says, no, you should stay here today. And fortunately, because of all these experiences in life where, I mean, over all these years, I think, I don't mean to say it in a arrogant way or whatever, but I think I'm pretty comfortable if I have to lie down on the floor and sleep or eat something simple. I think a lot of us, I'm sure many of us, you're like that too, I guess. So, or maybe eat, and you can straddle, because that's the kind of variety of experiences one has been exposed to. And so if you have to stay in a place which is really super comfortable too, you'll probably be okay with it. And just as in a place which people may define as being very uncomfortable, I mean, internally you are comfortable under your skin. So I think that's a good feeling. So I think you go with the flow. And at the same time, sometimes you don't want to disturb the so if you are with in a very formal setting with your colleagues, you don't want to make an issue out of it. So you have to probably go with the flow and respect what is being done by the collective. But intrinsically, you also yearn for those experiences, no, of just being, which sometimes is not very easy in a position of, you're always taken to these sanitized places and so. So you want to sometimes experience what it is like that. And if you like it, so if you like things that are good for you as well, so you're okay. I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I guess I will ask one question here about how. So what happens when you get stuck between what seem like two right choices or what seem like two really difficult choices? Because you have to, of course, you analyze and you look at the pros and cons, you look at the opportunity costs on all sides, and you come to some conclusion. But at some point, you know, one of our community members is this woman named Sister Lucy. And Sister Lucy's like, you know, she's an incredible human being. I mean, when she met the Pope says, I seek your blessing, Sister Lucy, you know. But Sister Lucy says that there's no one above me, you know, in her organization. And there's so many issues, so many challenges. It's just a complex situation. And she says, when I don't know, I just get down on my knees and pray. And I just kind of humble myself and I surrender and I say, I have no idea what to do. And so I wonder if there's like, do you, I mean, you must encounter these spaces, and what is it that, renews you? What is it that, reconnects you? How do you, maybe it's just prayer. You know, I there's a beautiful anecdote of Gandhi and right before the Dandi March, Tagore comes and says, Gandhiji, what do you, you know, the whole country is waiting for your next move. Like, what are you going to do? And he says, I don't know, but you can be sure that I'm praying. And so I wonder if you could share a little bit about like what happens when you're in those difficult spaces and you know that no matter which way you go, it's going to have tremendous consequences for society. What is your internal radar? Like, how do you go to that place in you? Like, what helps you? What are your tools?
So I think you've got it absolutely right. I think, Nipun, this is that little space within is something that one constantly tries to be connected with and dip into. I wouldn't say ideally if minute to minute or all the time one was able to remember, that would be ideal. I'm not sure I am able to remember that all the time, but certainly on a daily basis, there is this effort to, and you can sense it. You can see there are days when you feel you've gone a little in terms of, you may find you've been a little impatient. There are days, and I think if you're reflective, you get to know a host of things that you possibly did reasonably well and possibly things that you could improve. And I think that time with yourself, and sometimes it's just time, moments of silence, where whether you're sitting quietly, and I've also had this experience of vipassana. I think you've done that too. These are all different tools that I think really, if you do it with that element of faith, it helps you. And music too, prayer has been very good. And I must say sometimes, I think this feeling that existence or the divine, whatever word you may want to see, is so helpful, is so kind and gracious. I mean, I'll give two examples. There've been moments when you really felt lost. During the COVID crisis, for example, I was on the hot seat, and in a way, you constantly under attack for different reasons, because it's not to blame anybody, but there was, you know, media, and this was a pan India phenomenon, I'm sure, media trying to point out, because they too were trying to figure out why is it that this is happening. And the truth also was that, you know, you had capacity, let's say, for X in terms of hospital beds, etc. And suddenly, if the number goes up, maybe 10 times that, 20 times that, and world over, you had situations where there weren't sufficient ventilators. We probably didn't have such a difficult predicament here, but it was pretty challenging. You were really stretched on all counts, etc. So there would be moments, for example, I had to go and camp in Surat. So in one of the meetings, and in Rajkot, I mean, as the principal secretary health, it was decided suddenly that, you know, you have to go and camp there. And camp didn't just mean sitting in the offices. Going with your sincere nature, even in Gujarat, while you were there in the headquarters, you would want to go to hospitals, because if you have to lead your team, you can't sit at the back and tell them, yeah, you go and fight. I think you have to be with them. And that's when they really, mentally, they're all stretched. And what incredible work, whether it was nurses, doctors, and I'm sure, I easily, there is a 20% of any of, it's like a Gaussian distribution. You have about 20% of our teams in the government as well, who are absolutely, I would say, brilliant, amazing in terms of all-roundedness, very committed. But there could be another 20%, which is probably the other extreme, maybe due to certain experiences, a little recalcitrant, a little, difficult. But there is another 60%, which is in the middle, which a little bit of motivation, boom, you see, and that impact is huge. I mean, it is. So when you had to go, you really didn't have solutions, really, because even medication, they would say, well, tocilizumab was there. But maybe 2 weeks later, the company that manufactures it goes on their website and says that this is not the right medicine for it. So there was also, this is something from the highest level, whether it's WHO or the top researchers with the best of intentions, best of efforts, you didn't have, it's as if you were constantly walking on eggshells. But as you said, on a daily basis, this would be your prayer, and say that, well, with the limitations of whatever I have, the senses, whatever I can see, with this mind, whatever that is possible, I'm trying to do my sincere best, and the rest of it, you have to take care of it. And I found that existence literally carries you that way, notwithstanding the challenges. It's not that it's been a bed of roses, but with all the difficulties, I think end of the day, you did reasonably well. 2 days back, I'm told our team in Gujarat, I was very happy we got an award by the India Today Group for doing best work in vaccination. And I think it's an award for each one of the team members, the ASHA workers onwards, all the doctors, our immunization officer, Nayan Bhai. I mean, so many of them who day and night, it was like 18 hours a day, 20 hours a day. And when you're being constantly, there's the public literally shouting you know, all kinds of curses on people. Not, it's just that, you know, they've lost their near and dear ones. So in those circumstances, to retain your patience, your composure and work. On the other hand, sometimes I've also experienced another strange phenomenon. I remember this was years back, probably in 95. We were having this scarcity work, which means that when there's no rains, you have a lot of these works which are taken up, relief work, so to say, to provide employment to people. So suddenly I went on a visit. I used to go for these weekly visits, and I found a huge increase in the number of laborers in a particular taluka, which is like a block or a geographical unit, tehsil. And having visited it, something intuitively told me that this is just not right. We should not allow it. It seemed like a major attempt at malpractice. I mean, there was a certain number. Suddenly the number shoot up. It couldn't have happened. So in the meeting, at the spur of the moment, something inside me told me, and I was very strict. I said, we're stopping all the works from today, period. Everybody, there was suddenly a lot of hue and cry, because it's also a very sensitive issue, you know, if people, because this is for food for those, it's like, you know, you're not a cash dole, but you're actually giving them wage employment for doing this. So it could have been a very difficult situation, but something, and I really was probably being a little cussed, but I felt this was not right. I'm not going to let this happen. I came back to Jamnagar, slept through the night, but I wasn't very happy about what happened, but I felt that, you know, you had to put your foot down. Now I wake up in the morning, and suddenly I get to know that that night it's rained something. It was unexpected. It's rained something like, I don't know, some 16 inches, something unbelievable. So you do realize that sometimes when you do foolish things, but maybe if it comes from that space of good intention, sincerity, then nature also tries and helps you, covers you up. So I said, there's a saying, Khuda mehelban to gadha pehelban. The translation is, well, I think all of us understand it. So a lot of times you do what you think, but I think you have to be, you do what you think is correct, and not in, in an arrogant way, but yeah, I think.
Yeah. Oh, that's fabulous. Thank you. Thank you for sharing wonderful stories. And as you might imagine, I don't even need to make an announcement that if you have questions, you can ask, because we have a lot of questions. I don't think we'll be able to get to all of them, but we're going to see how we can weave some of them in. On behalf of Swara, Jayanti, Ben, we also have a whole bunch of rapid fire questions that we may ask you at some point. So we'll get to that. Maybe we, if I can invite Arzu to ask a question to start, and then and we'll proceed forward with the Q&A. Go ahead, Arzu.
Thank you, Nipin Bhai. Thank you, Jayanti Ma. So knowing your experience working at scale and working with so many different communities in so many different contexts, I really wanted to know that how has your experience been with perhaps some sort of collateral damage to goodness, in the sense that when you're trying to do good for some community, I'm assuming because the fabric of the community is so diverse and there are so many different types of people, that perhaps your very strong intention to do beautiful things with a lot of love for one set of community might also bring up certain challenges for another that, you know, might just be unpredictable or something that you need to take a hard call for. So how has your experience been with that? Because problems are massive, the scale is big, and it's very complex, and every individual is being impacted, and you hold so much agency. So they look up to you with a lot of expectation. But then in your huge intention of doing good with love, has it also been, have there been experiences where you have sort of struggled with some sort of collateral damage to goodness, if I could use that term?
Yes, Arzu, there's one experience that comes to my mind. And I don't know, but it's just that one, I thought it was something very unexpected that surprised me. I'm just as I think the name of the village was Saragva Mahudi. It's a little village near Lunavada. You see, this is post Godhra, when we were trying to rehabilitate people who were in the relief camps. I mean, you couldn't, everyone had to go back to their own homes. You can't have people, you had to get the community back into that state of harmony, even if it was difficult, slowly. So we used to have these meetings with the villagers, with a few representatives of both the communities first, separately, you know, each one-on-one with each group, and then slowly get them together and then make sure it's in readiness, go to the village, sit with them, and then slowly sometimes as many as 13 meetings, because sometimes for healing to happen, there cannot be a shortcut, but that doesn't mean you wait for long. So we needed to have these conversations, hear them out sometimes for 3 hours, 4 hours. So in one of these villages where the idea was basically to get the Muslim members of that village who had been in the relief camp back to the village, we were having a meeting there. And I distinctly remember that when we went to the village, generally you prefer to have the village meeting in a totally neutral place. It could be like the panchayat ghar or, you know, the village office. But sometimes in a situation like this, where you want to win over the support of maybe some of the leaders there, so that they take the responsibility of ensuring that nothing untoward happens when the members of the minority community actually come to the village, you need them also to be on your side. I hope I'm clear. So we decided to have this meeting in the house of one of the so-called Agewans, one of the leaders of that village who belonged to the majority community and also maybe one of the upper castes of that community, which normally one wouldn't do. But then, you know, these things are ethically, but you do have to be expedient sometimes and take a decision which is more appropriate for that context. I remember I was invited to that village. When I went in there, the sarpanch, it was a lady, she came into, as soon as I got down from the car, she was very happy with her husband and she was talking to me, etc. But we went to the house, she said she'll get members from different, faliyas or different hamlets of the village or different, people live in different parts of the village. She said, I'll collect them for this meeting and so on. And the meeting had started, you had members of the Muslim community, members of the same village of the Hindu community, and you were trying to bridge and tell them that, you know, we've all been brothers for long and this may be an isolated aberration we need to. But one kept waiting for the sarpanch to return, the lady who was the sarpanch, or the sarpanch is the president of the local self-government institution, which is like a gram panchayat, the village, elected body. So she hadn't returned back, and I kept asking 4 or 5 times, and it was probably about 2 hours, and I was really a little irritated. I thought, why on earth is she not coming back? So I, a bit of anger, acted angry, and I said that, I mean, why do you want us to wait like this forever, and what is this, and that sort of a little bit of anger. And then she did come, but to my surprise, she squatted at the threshold of the house. And I couldn't understand what was happening. And I still continued with a bit of anger. And we had a very sensitive officer with me. He, on a piece of paper, had written down all the names of the people who were participating. And that's when my eyes fell on the name of the sarpanch. And I realized she belonged to the scheduled caste community. And so it all, within minutes, I had to figure this out. And then now, if I put the onus on her, I was insisting that she come in, and she was probably respecting the local tradition, which was that she doesn't enter that house. Now, if I had made her vulnerable, it would have been bad, and neither did I want to go back with this message that the sarpanch, being the legitimate head of this decision making, was not a part of the meeting. So I had to pretend that I was very angry. At the presence of mind, I kind of said that this is really strange that I'm here and you're not walking in and being a part of this meeting. And so the onus was on the hosts there to ensure that she came in, because otherwise, if she had come in without, so they, the house, the person's house that we were sitting in, he insisted that she come. She kept saying no, but they came. So sometimes it's things like this, which I don't know if this answers your question, but this happens a lot of times, and it's sometimes very sensitive. And this may have, as I left the village, I felt a little uncertain, unsure. I wasn't sure if I had really exposed her, because she had come in, of course, at my instance and sat there, because she was just squatting at the entrance of the house. She wouldn't come in because of, you know, the dynamics of caste and the fragmentation. Very strangely, members of the Muslim community were sitting together with the Hindu community members of that house. But any kind of differentiation, whether it is religion-based or caste-based, is unacceptable in today's date and time, gender-based. But I was very surprised that, so one did feel that she may get hounded out tomorrow, or, you know, because there are these power structures, and you can't, after you leave, they may say that, well, I'll take care of you kind of thing. And so I had to be the villain out there and really act very angry and say that you better come in, etc. So the onus would be on me. So, and of course, for a few days, several days after that, I would keep checking informally to make sure that things in the village, it's all okay for her and she's not in any way victimized by the powers that be. So sometimes you do feel like you're walking on eggshells. But I guess in a position of leadership, you have to make those changes. But if you sort of take it head on, if it's a head on collision, also sometimes the collateral damage that you do for the people may be much more. So sometimes it has to be a subtle, sometimes acting that you didn't quite understand what happened, but you wanted her to be there, etc. I'm not sure if that was necessarily the right approach or not, but I don't know if that answers you, Arzu, in a small instance.
Well, I'm guessing there's no right answer to these things because it's just complex. I mean, there's no recipe. Like, you can't get a guidebook at Harvard that tells you this is how thou shalt do, because then, you know, you wouldn't have humans there. So these are complex things, and how we live with them, how we sleep with them, is even more complex an inquiry. So there's a bunch of questions, so I'm going to go to Vijayamji next.
Namaste, Nipun and Jayanti ma'am. Namaste.
Namaste.
As I was listening to you, I was praying, may you be blessed and may your tribe grow. That was my prayer. And my question is this. I'm sure in your tenure, many times, you know, there must have been occasions when you were torn between the, you know, rule book and the law of love. If at all it has happened, we would love to know. You know, maybe one anecdote, or how did you resolve such, problems, issues?
What a beautiful question. And Vijayamji herself has been a school principal for majority of her career. So an honor to have you here, Vijayamji.
I think many instances, but I'm just wondering what would be the right... can I think and come back in a few minutes, Vijayamji? We'll take
absolutely
another question.
Absolutely, ma'am.
We could take a moment of silence too. So.
It's like I remember. There's one instance that comes to my mind. Of course, long back. This was one of those midday meal programs. I was the midday meals commissioner, and I'd gone to visit one of the schools where this was, the midday meal program was going on, and it was an afternoon time, and I wanted to attend it and just see how it is being implemented. And I remember that, the facts exactly are not clear, but it was something like this, that there was a girl who was serving food, and one realized that she seemed below age. You see, normally to be a midday meals worker or supervisor, you have to be of a certain age and serve the meals. She was less than that prescribed age. It seemed like a young girl. And so this was something that one could have taken action against. But when I really got into this and started talking to her and understanding, but realized that actually she came from a family which had a problem of, there was some economic problem. And she was incidentally a very bright girl in her class, but had to give up her education. And she was working as a helper for the midday meals scheme. So it was like two things in a way stretching at the same time. You felt that she was breaking the law in a way by being someone who's below that age and doing this work. And also she was someone who was very good in her studies, but then because of conditions at home, this money that she was getting by being a helper was really very important for her mother, and she was therefore coming here to work. So the way I think we resolved it is we got somebody from the village who could sponsor her studies. So we said, you go back, because she was very good in her studies. She could have been a topper. Of course, I should go back and figure out where that child is today, what she's doing. For all you know, maybe after a year or two, she may have just got married and lost. Not that getting married is a problem, but maybe her studies may have discontinued. I've not. But I do remember this. This was in a village somewhere on the way to Patan. And I'd also written about it back then. So got the villagers to say that you must fund her studies or whatever. There was some commitment at home that prevented her from coming. And she was too young to be doing that kind of work. So you come across this a lot of times. And while the rule book or rules would want it to be done in a very cut and dry manner, that you just dismiss her from the work. But you realize that the root cause in this particular case was something else. I don't know if that answers you or one small instance, but I'm sure there are many such cases where you are a little torn between the rules and what you think is expedient. And, you know, we all are from the Gujarat cadre. I take pride in being an officer of the Gujarat cadre. And we also try and negotiate and find some way which is a little practical. That's the word that we use. You're not violating the rules, but you try and find a solution which by taking maybe contribution from someone locally too, because there are many people, benevolent people, who want to contribute for such causes. So if you can have both the issues resolved, sometimes you try and find that sweet spot where you can resolve. And I think I've been very fortunate that the Gujarat has enabled that to happen in a lot of cases. Of course,
What's very interesting is in the Panch Shakti that we referenced earlier, the government was actually the pinky finger, the smallest finger in Vinoba's vision, in the sense that I think there's rules that are made by society, and then there's rules of nature, right? The law of love versus the law of government kind of thing. And if you have a conflict between the two, I would imagine someone like a Gandhi would choose the law of love. But it's never as easy as, oh, this is law of love and this is law of government. It's much more intertwined, and it's moment to moment. It's dynamic, and it's rooted in your awareness. So it's almost like a skilled artist that you have to approach these things. So beautiful. Thank you, Vijayamji. Maybe we'll have time for one more question, and then maybe we'll still do some Q&A. I'll go to Nilima next. And if she has a question, from your new place, Jayanti Ben, in Auroville. So Nilima, please.
Thank you, Nipun, and thank you, Jayanti Ben. It's just such an honor, such a privilege, and to hear that you were mentored by Kirit Joshi himself, you're just so blessed. I'm a follower of Sri Aurobindo and the mother, so my deep curiosity is, Auroville is a unique experiment in working out human unity. So in your role as the secretary of Auroville Foundation, which aspect of the mother's vision are you seeing manifesting smoothly, and which seems to be challenging? And why do you feel so, and how are you looking to work with both?
That's a lot of questions in one, but yeah, maybe those are all relevant questions.
Double barreled, but triple barreled question. I think three of them together. Okay.
You can answer just whichever one works for you.
Sure. I think I'll be upfront and just share that one of the things that, on joining and sitting with all the different stakeholders here, one of the things that came through was that, you know, the original dream that mother had, and that's how everything, it was about a city. Auroville as a place where you would have a population of about 50,000 is what she had envisaged, and that's how we'd gone about procuring all this land, and most of it in the inner city. We have procured nearly 80% plus of the land, more than that actually, and therefore whereas the population actually is much less than that as we have it now. And the idea was to manifest or help manifest a city which would really, be a beacon for the rest of humanity, the rest of the world. And that is why this was something that was so close to the mother, and she worked on it, making it happen. And so one of the things that I felt we should be doing as one got you know, involved in this in the beginning was about trying to understand the crown. And I did realize that there may be a lot of issues within Auroville which need to be harmonized. And unless we all collectively come together, it may be difficult. And so maybe while figuring out what are all the issues, maybe one of the things that we placed our finger on without realizing it was something which may have been a little contentious. But I think the good news is that, because sometimes if you crack a difficult problem, then I think a lot of other things start falling in place. So I must say that it started with the Crown Walk. And then after that, as we have been having series of meetings with all the stakeholders, different people, I think slowly we are coming closer and closer to that possible solution. Of course, it's always a question of both sides, everybody, all the parties giving in a little bit. If we do that, it'll really help the city manifest and really make it make the dream of the mother. I mean, what the charter said, what was her, what was it that she envisioned, really take shape. So I think this is something that I realized. But if we crack this, I also realize that a lot of this conversations or communication across different groups, probably for whatever reason over time, had probably got ossified, and there wasn't this really open space for communication which started. But then there are also, being a small community of about 3,000 people, we all have our imprints, our views, counter views, etc. So it will also take some time for all of that to get healed. But I also realize that here there is, I mean, this force of mother which is working, and it will manifest. It has to manifest. But we have to be open sort of for it to really happen. And I think we're pretty much there, and looking at the way we're getting response now from so many corners. Of course, this is not to say that everything is hunky-dory, but there are challenges. But I think it's work in progress. And I must say that we've come a long way from where we started during the Crown Walk. And if we're able to crack this, I think it'll be a big, big, big step forward for Auroville as a whole. And the other thing is about this multiversity. We realize that Auroville was envisaged by the mother as a center of unending learning, and learning not just vidya, you know, avidya and vidya, as we said, that not just on the physical plane, but then the spiritual plane as well. So it really has to be an interplay of this. And in that context too, I see that this whole idea of the multiversity that is taking shape, because literally every entity in Auroville is a place which is so full of possibilities for learning. And if we are able to make that available for people in Auroville as well as people from outside, online, on-site, a combination of it, but curated properly, I think it will be a huge contribution for the rest of the world. And in the process, I think Auroville too will benefit tremendously from it. So I think these are one easy, and which appears easy. Now, God knows, maybe because all this is, you know, we're all working in the plane of possibilities, and it's rife with so many dynamic things. But I'm absolutely hopeful that collectively, with an amazing set of people who are here, I think each one of them has given up all those comforts of life elsewhere to come here and really create, co-create something new for the whole of humanity. So I think if we all collectively are able to crack some of these things, of course, with her grace, we could be a beacon for many other things to manifest.
Yeah. Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you. And Nilima, there was actually a wonderful anecdote when Jayanti Ben was in Auroville at some point, she had her dissertation on her laptop, and she put the laptop somewhere. She was just like, you know, and wherever she put it, someone else comes in and says, "Hey, ma'am, you can't really, that's the mother's altar. You can't put your laptop there." And in so many ways, years later, she is back using, you know, that PhD dissertation that was on her laptop at the feet of the mother, now is in position to perhaps enact it. So, you know, no accidents, as they say. Thank you so very much for your question. And Jayanti Ben, we're looking forward to it. We are a little over. We have a few more questions. I wonder, Jayanti Ben, if you can stay over for maybe 10, 15 more minutes.
Yeah.
Then maybe we can do a quick round of just, you know, back and forth Q&A. Here's one from Brenda. And these don't need to be elaborate. You could just, whatever comes to your mind. And some of them are silly too and fun. So you can respond however you're moved. And feel free to take as much time as you want in between. But Brenda asks, you know, do you feel burnt out? Do you ever feel burnt out? You know, when you get tired, what do you do to rejuvenate yourself?
I do feel like, for example, today I've started following the Ekadashi for several years now, and yesterday was the Ekadashi. It's also because it's just a small discipline. So today I'm fasting. So suddenly there are moments when I feel a little, but I guess you let your thoughts or whatever, something guide you. And I think sometimes the most beautiful inspirations happen when your mind stops or interfering. I don't know.
This is true. So we have another question that says, can you share a moment when you felt deeply connected with the power of love? We have many examples of people who are moved by the love of power, but you know, in your life, what has been a power of love example?
There's so many instances, Nipun, you feel that ultimately that is the only thing that works, everything else. So there's one about, you know, I was looking after pulse polio, the vaccination, long back. I mean, the polio vaccination was a thing. And we were in a village in Gujarat, which happened to be a village called Tal Gajada. And we were really trying to, there were about 13 cases of acute flaccid paralysis, which is an indication of people not being vaccinated and got a polio-like condition. So we were really worried, and we found that there were a large number of families which were resistant to or not wanting to get themselves vaccinated. So we started pretty early that morning and went on till evening, trying everything possible to, you know, cajole them, and then sometimes slightly sternly ask them to, you know, everything was being tried. And finally, I was at my wit's end, but I thought there's no way you can use force. I mean, that's not on. You have to figure out how you can. So it was almost evening sunset had happened. It was around 7:30 in the evening from morning. So it was something like 7-8 hours. You were sitting there and you said, my God, how do you crack this problem? And while all this was on, and because it so happened that once when someone was vaccinated with polio, coincidentally, someone developed polio. It had nothing to do with the vaccination, but because maybe there was already virus, and that same night they developed high fever and they had a death. So somehow this had gotten people to feel this was not to be done. And we were not able to obviously influence them, convince them, or move them to believe that this was possible. But that night there was a certain thing, something phenomenal, beautiful that happened around then, as just as we were literally at our wit's end. We thought, you can't use force, you can't, and you didn't want to. I mean, that was the last. So you found one primary school teacher who was absolutely frail, not 6 feet tall at all. He was probably 5 feet something, soft spoken. And it's as if a magical angel turned up, and he lifts all those 13, 14 children from that community whose mothers and fathers were resisting. So that's the kind of influence. I, in fact, thought that even if the president of India probably came there, he couldn't have done anything. But this teacher, so that's the influence the local teacher had. And he was probably working with the community, very, very soft-spoken person. Suddenly came like an angel. He got them. The mothers were absolutely okay. And we completed the targets as in, because I didn't want to. I decided I'm not going to leave this village till I complete this today. I was a little adamant. But so were the people. So now this beautiful thing happened. So that is sort of tattooed in my mind. I don't know, long answer to it.
That's great. That's fantastic. There's a question about the most recent book you've read that has moved you.
Well, there is a book that I kind of go off and on read it. This is, I think, the Gita, Bhagavad Gita. And there is particularly, I'm kind of rereading the interpretation or translation by Eknath Ishwar. I'm sure you've heard of this.
Yes,
and so
yes,
that is something that I often like to read. And I find it very good. Of course, I also read Mother and Sri Aurobindo. That was again something that a gift that Kirit Bhai, Professor Kirit Joshi, gave to me. But this is another book that I really like, Gita, and the way he explains, I think his language is phenomenal. The examples that he gives, the way he connects it all, it's so to the rational, all that, you know, he's able to put it through so beautifully.
That's great. And perhaps on a related note, your favorite Gandhi anecdote?
I really like this. In fact, yesterday I was talking to a group of children who study at a school that we are collectively trying to facilitate and do. I mean, not as a part of the government, but there's a bunch of us, including someone, a Gandhian called Vasuben and Balchandra Bhai. I mean, we're all together in this, and we're trying to do this at a small place called Siholi in Gujarat. And so this is the it's a small incident that we've all heard about when he was in school, and I think there was a spelling inspection, and they were all asked to spell, and the word that he got wrong was kettle. And so maybe at that time the teacher was also trying to prod him, and Gandhi was something in him, a little stubborn part of him, which was absolutely rightfully stubborn, the part of him which he didn't know back then, but which was probably the beginnings of what he found as his continuing lifetime relationship with something called truth. It probably didn't allow him to look at his neighbor and copy and spell the word kettle the way it had to be. And the teacher was really trying to probably scold him, put pressure on him in a very discreet way because the inspector was there. But probably as he walks back home that day, he didn't confront the teacher with a loud voice. He didn't argue with him. He didn't cry. He didn't break down. But I think in a very quiet way, there was something huge happening within him, which gave him the power of truth. And I think that was the beginning of the germination of that seed. It was there in him, just as it probably is there in all of us, but it probably really through life, it was that little sprout, that the sprouting that happened, it made him realize that what is the price I pay for sticking to it, and what is the cost? The teacher scolded me, I was humiliated in front of the class, all of it, but still I choose this because I value this much more. And I think that incident is something that has always meant a lot to me, to follow what you feel needs to be done, what you think is right.
Yeah, beautiful. Here's a more fun question, maybe. It says, you are a performing classical singer. What is your view on Bollywood music? Because clearly it reaches a lot of people, but how do you hold that?
I think Bollywood music also has some amazing songs. It's just that not all songs are something that, you know, appeal to me, but there's some beautiful songs of Bollywood too, which I think are amazing. And music is music. I mean, I when I was younger, when I used to have these more rigid ideas, I used to think classical music is a different box. It is. But I think any music which is elevating, it doesn't matter if it has this label of being film music or this. I think music is music. And there are some songs which are absolutely, they touch your heart. They elevate you. They're really good. So I love Bollywood music too, but not all of them. Some of them, yes.
On that note, can I ask you to retell that story, which I thought was so touching, when we were having a conversation and Swara asked you about something on your bucket list, and you spoke about a moment with your music teacher, which I thought was really touching. And can you share that story? Do you know which one I'm referring to?
No, would you have to again? I'm a little.
You had said that your music teacher was almost practically on his deathbed, and he said something about wanting to be of service.
So this is I've just as I hopped in and out of so many schools, I had several music teachers. So my relationship with music teachers also goes through a curve of initially, almost being a rebel and not wanting to learn. So when I'd come back from school, my parents wanted me to learn the local music. So it started with that sort of a thing until, I shared with you about this music teacher that I met at Hanumangarh, where I learned these shabads, the Gurbanis, that especially this beautiful Awwal Allah, that the prayer that was so beautifully sung today at the beginning. But similarly, there was this person, he actually lived till he was about 101, someone who's basically a medical doctor. He was called Sripad Pinakapani. He was a Padma Bhushan as well, which is a great honor. You see, the Indian government bestows this honor on people. And he was a medical doctor working in the Karnool Medical College. But then he was someone who had from childhood this huge passion for music, and not just to listen, but he was a practitioner himself and had taught a lot of people. And he was also absolutely amazing as a doctor. He was into tennis. He was into, he would be driving, car rallies and a host of things, a very good tennis player, etc. But I got to meet him once on my election duty, and I was in this place called Karnool, and it was when I went there and they said, you're posted here after a day or two. I wondered, why would existence, there must be something more. I have these conversations, meditations, if you will, with me, where I sat silently and kind of was fighting with the divine and asking, why have you sent me here? What am I, is there something special? And then probably a few hours from then, I find someone from the music college who comes to meet me. And then he says, well, there's a 98-year-old gentleman. I said, wow. He explained his name and that he was a Padma Bhushan. And I ran to him. And I think from that day onwards, after I finished all my office work, literally from about 7 in the evening sometimes till late night or whatever, for several hours a day, I would spend time with him learning absolutely soaking and drinking in all the music that he could offer to me. What a beautiful mind. And it was amazing what all he taught me. Of course, he was also a little short-tempered sometimes when I didn't get the notes right. So he would scold me. I would feel very, at that stage in life, you realize no one scolds you. So I would really sometimes wonder. But then it was such a beautiful experience. I would go back and sit and ask myself, well, you want to learn? And if there's somebody who's, absolutely a doyen in this, and you're getting a lifetime opportunity to learn, and the reverence for him, I think. So there is a monkey in our minds, which keeps popping up every now and then.
And you were sharing how then towards the end of his life, like he said, I just want to be of service. I just want to contribute. And that touched you deeply, right?
So he had literally he was prone. He was in a condition where he couldn't walk and all of it. But what a brilliant mind his was. He would be singing songs and teaching me for several hours. And also sometimes this whole thing of improvisation. We do what is called manodharmam, or the creativity, which is never really. It's not like Western music or what we all learn in our Western education. Everything is parsed, everything is taught to you, this is the way you do it. But sometimes creativity in the traditional way is not something that is very clearly spelled out and taught. They say that, well, this is the raga, these are the notes, now you create and so on. But with him, since he had this Western education, he was a medical doctor who had also published in publications like Lancet, can you believe it? So he was an outstanding person on many dimensions. So he kind of analytically explained this whole thing of how to improvise etc. So our classes would go on for long, and I think it was a beautiful experience learning from him.
That's great. I guess one last question here. Well, if you had a favorite prayer, what would it be? And if you can you sing it for us? You can pass on that if you'd like, but.
No, I would love to sing that. Favorite prayer. So there is one that apparently Gandhi, since we're also coincidentally, it's something that it's a prayer that Gandhi loved. He's apparently believed to have asked M.S. Subbalakshmi, who was India's first Bharat Ratna in music and the first Padma Shri, Padma Bhushan in music, which I didn't know till I did a program on her a few years ago at Saptak, about, we call it Katha Nritya Geetam, where you try to weave in the life of someone of that stature with music, stories, and dance. And that's when you started researching, you found so many amazing things about her. She was also also very well known initially as a popular film star. Her film called Meera has Sarojini Naidu give the introduction, and it went on as a historic movie, breaking all the records and so on. So this is a song which apparently Mahatma Gandhi asked her to sing. He was very fond of MS and her rendition of bhajans. So she said she didn't know it and said that, would it be okay if someone else sang it? To which Bapu is said to have replied, I'd rather have you recite the words than anyone else even sing it. So she took it as a great compliment also, but also as a great, nudge for her to learn it. And she did learn in the subsequent year. I think, if I'm right, probably late night of the 1st of October, she sang, the recording was completed at All India Radio, and it was sent dispatched in the aircraft for the 2nd of October that year the Mahatma, for Gandhiji to hear it, listen to this. He was moved by it, they say. But subsequently that year, unfortunately, end of that year, beginning of the next year, he died. And on his death, I believe All India Radio, the first song that they played was this bhajan by M.S. Subbalakshmi, which is a beautiful bhajan. And if you like, I would attempt to sing it, Nipun.
Please, it would be an honor.
Hari Tuma Haro Jan Ki Peer, Hari Tuma Haro Jan Ki Peer, Draupadi ki laaj rakhi tum badhayo ji, Hari tumharo jan ki pi, bhakt karan roop nar hari dharyo aap sharir, Harinakashyap maralino dharyo nahin dheer, Hari tumharo jan ki peer, बूढ़े गज राज रखो कियो बार नीर, बूढ़े गज राज रखो कियो बार नीर, दास
Giridhar Das Meera, Das Meera Lal, Giridhar Das Meera Lal, Giridhar Dukh Jahan Tahan Pe Hari 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 Tum Haro Jan Ki Pe
Such an honor to know you and to be in the field of your love. I think the world knows you for all the external things you're doing, but actually what makes me smile is the incredible ways in which you pray to be an empty channel for a greater force. And you have always done that. You have inspired others to do that. And I know I speak on behalf of so many of us saying thank you for being who you are, for inspiring us. And we're very grateful that you took time just even to be here on this call.
Thank you, Nipun. And I appreciate all your patience in bearing with whatever I tried to say, whatever, I don't know, I'm certainly not worthy of any of this, but I think it's your love and just need this mutual prayers from all of us, that all of us are able to be the change that we want to see and in our own way make a difference. And I think it is a beautiful world, but I'm sure there's a lot each one of us can do. Thank you so much for the wonderful things you are doing. You've always been an inspiration, and may the force be with you always, Nipun, and to all the beautiful people watching this. I think collectively, there's so much that we can all do. And
may all good things come to life. Thank you so much. Thank you all. Thank you, the volunteers, and thank you, all the listeners. Thank you to all the listeners for being here holding space. We'll follow up with all the details and ways to continue to engage at the intersection of this Panch Shakti and our deeply profound law of love. So good night, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.